helpful to us. Don't say that.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Members of the committee, my name is Donald Platt. I'm project director for the Criminal Law Revision Commission, and I have just some very brief comments I would like to make to the committee today, introductory in nature to Article 8 of Senate Bill 80. We have here with us today Bert Gustafson, who was a member of the commission staff, served as research counsel, and did the basic research and the primary drafting of this article. And he will speak to the article itself in more detail, but by way of some general background, I think that to place the recommendations that the commission has made in perspective, it's important to note that the Manhattan Bail Project pioneered the development of very much improved fact-gathering information for the bail decision and the expansion of RORs, or releases on recognizance. This was under the auspices of the Vera Institute and the Institute of Judicial Administration at the New York University Law School. Now, the success of this project, which occurred early in the 60s, led to the National Conference on Bail and Criminal Justice in 1964. Similar bail projects have sprung up across the nation since that time. An example is the San Francisco Bail Project, initiated in 1964. The state of Illinois radically revised its bail statutes in 1963. New York has a new proposal before it at the present time, which would do away with the bail system entirely. And I would call your attention to an Oregonian article, a clipping from the Oregonian, dated Wednesday, January 3rd, 1973, and I have submitted copies of that clipping to your clerk. I would like to quote a couple of things. The temporary commission on the New York State court system has been reported as saying in its recommendations for some sweeping overhauls of the New York State courts. In its report, at least that part of the report dealing with bail reform, the New York report called the New York bail system an anachronism that, quote, denies equal protection by imprisoning the poor and releasing the wealthy, unquote. I think that's one consideration that this committee should keep in mind. It was one consideration that was certainly very important to the Criminal Law Revision Commission as it attempted to develop some new procedures in this area. That is not the only consideration, however. Going back to the chronology of the bail reform movement in this country, the federal government adopted the Bail Reform Act in 1966 and created the District of Columbia Bail Agency to provide the courts with facts and recommendations regarding pretrial release of defendants. The American Bar Association, in its recently promulgated standards for criminal justice, which have been approved by the American Bar Association, urges the type of proposal not necessarily identical to the one you find in Senate Bill 80, but certainly of this type of proposal be adopted by the several states. The Criminal Law Revision Commission considers its proposals on release of defendants as one of the most significant and most needed of the procedural changes it is recommending in Senate Bill 80 to the 1973 legislation. It's important to note that although we recognize this is going to be a controversial area, contrary to search and seizure, which was also controversial, as this committee is well aware, and which had a very divided vote in the commission, I want to point out that with respect to Article 8 of this bill, no member of the Criminal Law Revision Commission voted against this article. Oregon has established itself as a national leader in criminal law and criminal procedure reform. I submit that adoption of proposed Article 8 would, in my opinion, give this state one of the best and most enlightened mechanisms with which to deal with this vital and heretofore neglected part of the criminal justice system. Thank you very much.
Questions of Mr. Palette? Senator Hoyt.
John, didn't we really take the first step 2 years ago in this direction? Criminal law revision work?
We proposed no changes in bail at that time, at least as part of the commission's work. There may have been some other bills before the legislation. Nothing that we recommend.
Further questions? Don, I think maybe I'm in the wrong part. One of the judges pointed out to me someplace where in the code, I suspect it's further on, where a release could be made by the sheriff without the judge's acquiescence. Is that in this section?
No, that's not in this section. Yeah. That deals, I think, with work release rather than what we're talking about. That is a separate recommendation, similar to the bill that was before the legislation.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Thank you.
Brian Hodges?
Senator Brown, and members of the committee, my name is Brian Hodges. I'm a lawyer from Eugene, Oregon, and I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar Committee on the Criminal Law and Procedure. It's the judgment of the Committee on Criminal Law and Procedure that we strongly and unanimously endorse Article 8 of this proposed procedure code. We did have two reservations about our endorsement. One related to the deletion of the last sentence of Section 244, Subsection 1. That appears at page 142 of the yellow book. It was our feeling that that sentence was simply redundant and not needed.
Would you point it out to us again, please?
It's the final sentence in subsection 1 of section 244. It reads, the defendant shall execute the security release in the amount set by the magistrate. It was felt that the immediately following language adequately expressed whatever it was that intended to express. The second reservation,
how you want to handle it, I don't necessarily agree that the first sentence covers it. Should I wait until the testimony is
No, let's put it in right now.
Okay. Well, the first sentence in sub 1 provides that the court sets the security amount, and the part that you seek to delete requires that the defendant himself execute it. Now, it might not be necessary to have the defendant execute it, but I don't agree that the sentence you seek to delete is redundant of the first sentence. So can you explain it to me?
I think I misspoke myself, or I was misunderstood. The sentence we seek to delete, we submit, is adequately covered by the first part of subsection 2, in other words, not the first part of subsection 2.
All right.
Our concern began when we noticed that security release should have gone on to say security release agreement, perhaps, but we felt that the first sentence of subsection 2, the immediately following sentence, in other words, basically covered anything that the second reservation that we had is perhaps more substantial, and that goes to the entire section 246 of the commission draft, which discusses forfeiture and apprehension. We felt that for purposes of our committee, we needed further review and further study of that section, and we proposed to submit to this committee and to any other committee that would be appropriate proposed amendments to the section. We did not get any such amendment prepared to present at this time, but we shall be working on that. Part of the reservations we had in that regard related to what we felt were inadequate provisions regarding remission procedures and things of that nature. We simply did not feel that we could endorse Section 246 as it is now written. The feeling of the committee was that this Article 8 would greatly facilitate the administration of criminal justice in the sense that it would bring the law regarding bail and release more closely in line with current experience in this area and would more adequately give a policy priority, at least, to releases without bail and set up adequate criteria in our judgment for other kinds of releases. That basically completes all the testimony that I'm authorized to give under the jurisdiction of this committee.
Thank you. Questions of Mr. Hodges. Senator John Burton.
Well, Madam Chairman, Mr. Hodges, when this was in front of the commission, I thought that the bar committee was in favor of Section 246. Now, have they changed their position? Or
I was not on the committee in the early stages of the drafting of this, Senator. I was disappointed to the committee. We discussed it at some length, and we felt that there was simply not enough in here to protect everybody that it would seem needs protection. Bail bondsmen, defendants, other people. We thought, for example, that there ought to be some provision for a court or magistrate to forfeit something less than all of the security under certain circumstances. There ought perhaps, for a further example, to be some explicit provision for mitigation. The whole procedure regarding remission, we felt needed to be reworked, rethought, and redrafted. That's the current position. What any prior position was, I'm frankly not at all familiar with.
Further questions, Mr. Hodges? Thank you, Mr. Hodges. Mr. Gustafson.
Senator Brown and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is Bert Gustafson. I am a private attorney, and I was formerly employed by the Criminal Law Revision Commission as our staff counsel, and I was the reporter for this article to the commission. What I'd like to do is take a few minutes here and go over the basic point of this proposal, keeping in mind that the Portland City Club, the Oregon Conference of Bail and Criminal Justice, and the American Bar Association have approved a 10% deposit system. The present law basically leaves the release decision to the entire discretion of the judge. And there is no possibility of continuance of bail from one court to another court, from district court to circuit court. The defendant also must request a recognizance release if he desires such a release. Otherwise, the court will not consider a non-security release. The deposit of a security under the current law must be in the full amount under today's law. And as you are well aware, the commercial bondsmen require a non-refundable premium. And the full amount of the bond is generally guaranteed in some cases by real or personal property in addition to the premium. What I'd basically like to say here is that couple things. One, on how Article 8 protects the society and how Article 8 protects the defendant. First of all, I would offer that the interest of society is to bring the person accused of a crime to trial. First of all, Article 8 establishes guidelines and specific procedures for all courts follow in making release decisions. And that initially includes release criteria. Those are set forth in Section 237. And they generally follow the idea of community ties. If a defendant has strong community ties, he is less likely to flee the jurisdiction of the court. The Article 8 also provides for what's termed a release assistance officer. This person could be appointed by a magistrate if the magistrate deemed it necessary. In other words, if the load of bail or release cases coming up was such that the magistrate himself could not examine the release criterion, he could have a release assistance officer. In other words, in a town, say Eugene or Salem, they could hire a release assistance officer. Where you take a town like Tillamook, the judge knows quite a few of the defendants, and it's not necessary for him to have aid in determining whether or not he should release this person. The general contents of a release agreement are spelled out in Section 241. This would aid in conformity of release agreements from one area of the state to another area of the state. Each defendant must sign a release agreement. This was mentioned before in response to a question by Senator Burns. Each defendant must execute a release agreement, whether it be a conditional release, a personal recognizance release, or a security release. Article 8 sets forth three types of releases to give the court flexibility. These three types of releases are called initially a personal recognizance release, a conditional release, and a security release. The basic philosophy of Article 8 is to depart from the reliance on property as a guarantee of insurance and go for a reliance of criminal sanctions. Criminal sanctions being contempt and bail jumping, or what's called failure to appear. The conditional release is really fashioned for this express purpose, where a person who might not be eligible for personal recognizance release, say he does not have a job in the community, he's new in the community, or what have you, a conditional release could be fashioned by a magistrate. And this could take the form of releasing a defendant to a certain group. For instance, the person has an alcohol problem, he could be released to the Alcoholics Anonymous. Or a person could be released to a church, or whatever the judge or magistrate thought appropriate. The third type of release that could be fashioned is a security release. And as a scheme of things would have it, this is the least preferred of the three releases. Security release would be set when nothing else could be set. And within the security release would be essentially two types. The person, the defendant, could deposit 100% cash or property, real or personal, stocks, bonds, what have you, with the court. Or if he so chooses, he could deposit 10% of the base amount with the court. If he deposits 10% of the amount with the court, upon his appearance at all court dates, he could receive back 90% of that deposit. And I listed page 3 some examples of what would be deposited and what would be retained on various amounts of bonds.
Mr. Gustafson, we have a number of witnesses, and we have read it. If you could try to hit the high points.
All right. The the basic point on the on how the Article 8 protects society is that the release decision is judicially made. It's made by a magistrate or his designated representative to determine whether or not this person should be released. Our article would prevent the delegation of the release decision to someone else. This is not to mean that a person could retain a professional bondsman. He could. But the basic decision is judicially made by a magistrate using the release criterion. The Article 8 protects the defendant by allowing a individualization of the release decision depending on what his circumstances are. There also is created a presumption of personal recognizance in favor of the defendant. The presumption has the effect of requiring the magistrate to examine the release criteria before making a decision. In other words, without this presumption, the magistrate need not examine these criteria and may make a may not make a full decision. The speedy release can be also affected by the use of a security release schedule set by a magistrate and the time limitation within which a release decision may be made. This, the interest of the defendant, of course, is to allow him his freedom so he may prepare his defense. And also, this is in line with the presumption that the defendant is presumed innocent until proven guilty. I have submitted a summary of some statistics, and statistics are very, very difficult to isolate in these situations, especially when you're talking about 10% deposit bond. I have communicated with a judge, Peter Backcoast, who is a supervising judge in the surety section in Cook County, Chicago, Illinois, and their gross forfeiture rate for a 30-day period from 1969 to 1971 are approximately 12.5%. Now these figures have to be modified because this only includes a 30-day period. If we would examine that rate of those defendants who are ultimately lost to the criminal system, it would be one quarter to one third this amount, or roughly 3 to 5%. In Southern Illinois, the Illinois Law Forum has shown that the forfeiture rate varies between 0 to 4%. And in some counties, it was 0%.
Questions? Senator Keith Burns.
In Section 238, it says any magistrate may designate a release assistance officer. Does this contemplate that the Justice of Peace would have a release assistance officer? Was that contemplated by the commission?
Yes, I believe it was. The magistrate would be a Justice of the Peace. And in the cases where misdemeanors come before him, if he, as a magistrate, feels that he has too many, he cannot examine the release criterion, he could appoint a release assistance officer. I believe the effect of that, Justice of the Peace would probably not be that busy that he would need to appoint one. There would be a budgetary limitation by his, probably the county that he is authorized by.
Mr. Chairman, experiences lawyers have had when they have a magistrate who's not a lawyer, as soon as they have magistrate is much more talking about just the peace and not a lawyer. And that just the peace is much more strict in where they are a lawyer. And I was thinking that you put down the criteria for release and then they're making that more strict than what they would do probably for the release officer on the side of be on the safe side. It seems that you're going to make it even worse than it is now, as far as just the peace is concerned. For instance, just the peace over in Eastern Oregon, as even as a minor, a child had anything to do with stealing a calf or something, like that's more serious than murder. And but you, the commission, in your mind, did have in mind that a just the peace would also be able to appoint a elite assistant officer, is that correct?
Well, I don't really think so. I think what the thinking was here is in the larger counties, like Multnomah County, Lane County, Marion County, where there was quite a few people needing a release decision, an immediate release decision, then these magistrates would be overburdened. I think the thought of the commission was in these outlying areas, the magistrate would not be overburdened. And that's why we put in the word any magistrate may, taking into account the smaller areas, and you say Eastern Oregon or Western Oregon, where the justice of peace would not be that busy and would not have to perform. So I would say, no, they did not take that into account.
There is no definition of a released assistance officer in the code, proposed code of service.
No, there isn't. They just define his duties under Section 238.
Another question.
Thank you.
Over on.
Tonight, John, we're discussing on Section 136 that he may appoint a release assistance officer, and the witness has responded he thought this was in the larger, more populous counties. Can you clarify to us who might possibly be this release officer? Would it be a law-trained person, or
in the larger areas?
Mm-hmm.
Well, as I remember it from the commission, now the reconnaissance officer in Multnomah County was a former worked for the Board of Parole and Probation. He was not, he is not a lawyer, but I don't think that it was contemplated that it would necessarily have to be a lawyer. But I think that it was contemplated that whoever he may be would be conversant with the criminal justice system. And certainly, I think Gordon in Oklahoma County.
Senator Keith.
My concern, John, was where justices of peace would be. They're a magistrate, and under this code, authorized to designate a release assistance officer. And it seems to me like that's stretching yourself, by the way.
Well, Keith, it's the age-old thing that we got into with the Judicial Council's bill on transferring jurisdiction over probate matters to the Circuit Court, and then there would be a provision there for a judicial hearings officer, somebody that they said in their testimony in front of the committee could be the county judge. You got a situation in some of the smaller counties where you don't have any lawyers, you know?
Well, that isn't what bothers me. The bottom is if you have a non-lawyer selecting somebody that I assume would have perhaps less qualifications than the Justice of Peace, or you would ordinarily expect them to be Justice of Peace.
Yeah, okay.
That's my bottom.
All right, I can understand that, and I don't know whether we would accept that in the commission. If we did, perhaps Don or Bert can respond. I can't, Madam Chairman.
If I may,
yes,
Madam Chairman. We did discuss those issues. We didn't discuss leaving them out, however. We felt that we should stay with the same definition of magistrate that's in the code now, recognizing that it was highly unlikely that a JP would be appointing a released assistant officer, but at the same time recognizing that there might be situations where a need would arise, and recognizing also that this draft does not contemplate that release assistance officers would necessarily be paid employees. That if a magistrate was able, say through law students, some of the bail projects have done use law students, similar types of people to make use of this type of personnel, on a non-paid basis, to be authorized to do so. And we should not preclude him from doing so. And also, if he wanted to pay, he'd obviously have to get some money from the county.
Senator,
another question.
Let's finish.
He testified the whole article.
Okay.
It's within the article.
All
right. Or in 239, two times when a person indicates two different crimes, a person cannot be released on bail. That's murder or treason. And I'd like to know the last time a person was convicted in Oregon of charge of treason.
I tried to get Connell to reduce the charge of treason once, but he wouldn't do it.
You didn't have sufficient grounds for that.
What's that got to do with
it? Further questions?
No, I'm serious about this. We keep building this into exceptions. We do it with the death penalty and various other things, and why, just because a term is in the Constitution or wherever it is, I guess in the Constitution, why do we have to keep repeating something that has no business being written down again?
Senator Burns, the main reason this was placed into the section was because it's in the Constitution, and that the Commission did not make any judgment beyond that point.
Further questions of Mr. Gustafson?
I have that. I may.
Go ahead.
In the tail end of section 244, the next to last sentence, I don't understand. The stock, bond, real, or personal property shall in all cases be justified by affidavit.
This is the present statutory language incorporated here. But what it means basically is that a person, as I understand, will say these are the bonds I am depositing with the court. 100 American Airlines, 100 United Airlines, whatever, and they are worth whatever the current market value is. And he would, in other words, justify the existence and the value by affidavit, and then, of course, would have to deposit the certificates themselves with the court.
Well, at what point does he file his affidavit? At the time he deposits the bonds and so forth?
Yes, sir.
Well, it couldn't be with respect to ownership, because that would be obvious if you had him to be able to examine that. So it could only be respect to the present value. So that's what that means.
Yes.
Further questions of Mr. Gustafson?
Madam Chairman,
Senator Cook.
Has this discussion so far considered the her testimony relative to the bill that was adopted at the last session, which permits the judge to deny bail after conviction?
We haven't hit that specific point. Go ahead.
Is that in the proposed? It seems to be in the right to release of the defendant.
Is that on section 247?
Discuss.
Yes, it's section 247, subsection 2. After judgment of conviction, they can order the original release agreement stand pending appeal, or they can deny it, freeze it, reduce it.
Okay. Now, let's see. Under this statute, now, is it changed from the present law? After judgment of conviction in municipal justice or district court, the court shall order the original release agreement and its applicable security stand pending appeal, or deny, increase, or reduce the release agreement and the security. So is this the same as the present law, that after a misdemeanor conviction they can refuse to allow release on bail?
I don't believe so.
Well, the present law is that if he's convicted on a misdemeanor and you want to appeal it to the circuit court, that is assuming that up until July 1, you got to post bond on appeal.
Yeah. Does the judge have the authority to refuse to allow the release of the defendant on appeal.
Not present.
That's not in that bill?
Don't believe, no, I the present law.
It changed. How did the law, now I thought that this was one of the reasons why I, one of the several reasons why I objected to the passage of that law at the last session, was because it would allow a municipal justice or district court judge to refuse to allow bail. Am I wrong?
Well, that was insofar as felonies were concerned. There was an attempt made in that package bill that the chief judge had, which would permit the exercise of discretion as far as bail from circuit court on an appeal.
That is the law now.
Yeah, but...
doesn't that apply to misdemeanors?
Don't think so. I think we specifically amended misdemeanors out of it. But I believe in the bill as presented to the Senate committee applied to misdemeanors, and that was amended out. Now, you may remember that, Don. Am I right?
My recollection is that with respect to misdemeanors, that this draft does change the existing statute, and that this would be discretionary with the court.
Yeah, that's
under this proposal.
Under this proposal, it would be discretionary with the court for misdemeanors.
Yes.
All right, now, does anyone come in here? I'd like to hear a reason why they want that discretion.
Rather than as a matter of right.
Yes. I suppose you can, well, it occurs to me, perhaps there's an argument. I don't think I agree with an argument in the case of a felon for involved in substantial penalty. That maybe he's going to run away and won't be here after the appeal. But it's hard for me to see why they should have that right. Nobody's going to, or hardly anybody's going to leave the country in order to avoid at most a 1 year jail sentence.
Further questions of Mr. Gustafson? Thank you, Mr. Gustafson. Judge Allen? Judge Allen sent a letter and two exhibits which arrived this morning. I have to apologize to committee members that I haven't been able to duplicate them and get them to you.
Senator Brown, members of the committee, I note that the list indicates you're supposed to either say that you are in favor or against the proposed one. I checked both of them because I am in favor of some of the proposals and believe that some of them should be clarified. In the first instance, I'd like to speak to the release assistance officer, which I think is a very forward step in the administration of justice, particularly in the larger county. I know that it has been done and tried in other places. I think that this would give more courage to people who wanted to appoint a release assistance officer in order that they would know that they would have positive statutory authority for this person. I think that it might well be under the provision for release assistant deputy that in the larger jurisdictions it might be advisable to have them on a 24-hour a day call in order to take care of those matters which should be taken care of.
Is there any reason to try to further define it?
I don't see any reason to further define it. I think that when you get into more definitions and try and list the qualifications, you're liable to opt out people who have the most confidence of the magistrate, and the magistrate thinks can do the best job and work best with the magistrate. I wouldn't go a bit farther than this in trying to define who he might be. In regard to the section on the condition conditional release. I think that this is Section 243. I think that this is a very forward type step. It brings back the military concept to a certain extent, confinement to quarters, house arrest, this type of thing. My only comment in regard to that would be that in regard to the section, release of the defendant into the care of a qualified person responsible for supervising the defendant, I agree with the concept he should not be required to be financially responsible, nor should he have to forfeit money. However, I do think that there should be embodied in there a positive duty on the part of any person or organization responsible for the defendant. There should be embodied a positive obligation on the part of this person to immediately notify the court if the person in their custody should not comply with the conditions of the release agreement. The court has very little control over these people when they are released. And if you will note that there is a penalty on Section 248 of a supervisor who knowingly aids the defendant in the breach of a conditional release to be punishable by contempt, I simply submit to the committee that I think that there should be an affirmative duty on the part of the person to notify the court immediately. Otherwise, you're liable to have 2 months go by, and all of a sudden you call a supervisor and say, well, we're going to have a, we're sitting down here at 10 o'clock, we're about ready to have Joe's trial. Where's Joe? And he said, guys, forgot to tell you. Joe left for Mexico about 8 weeks ago. So Joe left. I don't think it makes that much difference. It's only an affirmative duty to notify the court in failure to breach some of these conditions. It doesn't appear that there are any. I think that there is a over-reliance when the act sets out relying on criminal sanctions instead of financial loss to assure the appearance of the defendant.
What?
There is an over-reliance?
Yeah, it's in Section 240. I think there's an over-reliance upon that philosophical approach, Senator. In the first place, it's impossible to impose criminal sanctions on someone who jumped the bail if you can't find him to impose the criminal sanctions on him. A little difficult to do that. The second is that my experience is, and when I talk about my experience, I want to qualify this, that I talk about my experience in Lane County because I don't have any experience anyplace else. So, my experience is that apparently the prosecuting attorneys are rather loath to bring charges against the defendant for bail jump. Once they get him bagged, they prosecute him for what he was originally charged with, and they seem to forget the bail jump part of it. Maybe in some counties they do bring more of these, but my experience in Lane County is that they don't do it. The section on, I want to bring one thing simply to your attention in regard to these releasable offenses. I concur with Senator Burns that we haven't had too many treason cases lately. We haven't had any in Lane County. It's interesting because there's another statute which says that you must release a defendant if he isn't tried within 60 days unless he's charged with a non-bailable offense. Well, one of the statutes in there says one of them that you have to and attempted murder and conspiracy to murder. So you have to let him out if you don't try him within 60 days. So he can get bail set on a murder charge. And if you don't try him in 60 days, you have to reduce the thing so he can get out of jail. but if he's just charged with attempted murder, you don't have to let him out of jail. Which seems like, you know, you shouldn't really benefit a guy by the fact he did a good job on it. I'd like to call to your attention the situations on Section 244, which probably bothered him more from a practical situation than the philosophic, a practical situation. The defendant must deposit properties equal to the security amount, whether owned by him or the surety. And it says, defendant may deposit. Defendant may deposit. So apparently it's the defendant who has to make the deposit. Now, I may have overlooked the appropriate provisions, and if I do, I'm willing to stand corrected. But I have ascertained no procedure under the Act for setting forth as to when and to whom the security deposit is to be returned if, in fact, there is no forfeiture. Now, if someone can point out to me where that section is, I'd be very happy to stand corrected.
Don, is there any answer to that? Or should I ask Mr. Gus?
Well, my recollection is you've got something here may be too general to pass on. Now,
without going into that further, one of the situations that's involved, of course, is that if the defendant, in fact, deposits them, and they belong to the surety, then everything's all over and well and good. I think that there ought to be some way to get them back to the surety rather than to give them back to the defendant. The possibility he may be long gone.
Senator Keith Burns.
Well, actually, the way it works now is that if a surety deposits it, then the surety gets the receipt, and he's the only one that can pick it up. And the attorney deposits, he gets the receipt, and he's the only one to pick it up. When the defendant does it, he gets the receipt.
Right.
And the fact that it restricts the defendant may deposit doesn't allow anybody else who may never get out of jail to be not in a position to take the clerk's office, right?
Right. But all I say is, Senator, it says that the defendant is the guy that does the deposit.
This could easily be corrected, I suppose, by adding at the end of the subparagraph 2, or his surety.
Yeah, and have some provision that when the thing's all over, whoever deposits gets it back. It's a mechanical thing.
Madam Chairman, now belatedly respond, we do have a sentence in here in subsection 2 of section 44. When conditions of the release agreement have been performed and the defendant has been discharged from all obligations and costs, the clerk of the court shall return to the accused unless the court orders otherwise 90% of the sum that has been deposited. We don't go any further than that as far as setting up the nuts and bolts of mechanics.
Of course, my comment to that, Mr. Collette, is that whole paragraph only applies to the 10% deposit. I don't see how you can skip from 10% deposit under that theory. Under your theory, the guy would only get 10% of the $50,000 if the security were deposited. I don't think you want that.
No, we don't. And I'm sure someplace in here,
I anticipate considerable trouble in the evaluation determination of ownership and physical storing of security deposits. I also have difficulty determining how one deposits real property in court. This is a brand new concept to me. I don't know whether you use a bulldozer or a shovel, depending upon how you do it.
Where is that, Judge Jones?
Huh?
Where is that?
Well, it says
244.
Yeah, 3. May deposit with the clerk of the court an amount equal to the security amount in cash, stocks, bonds, or real or personal property situated in the state, with equity not exempt. I just don't know how you deposit real estate in court.
Have a quitclaim deed?
Sir?
You would have to have a quitclaim deed?
Well, my point is, Senator Hoyt, I don't know how. And I've never seen it done. And my point is there, if you're going to have a way to do it, I think we ought to have a way to do it. Plus the fact that I think there ought to be some provision in that as to how this deposit in court would affect title and ownership and sale to a bona fide purchaser for value. And you deposit your homestead, and then you race out and sell it to Joe, and Joe says, I own the homestead, and the clerk says, I own the homestead. Well, who owns the homestead? I don't know. And I'm afraid that this, you see this, every court apparently under this, every court would have to figure out their own system as to how you do it, if you can do it.
Where is this?
244, Senator Cook. It's the third
line
paragraph.
From the bottom of page 142.
Amount equal in cash, stocks, bonds, real or personal property. I'm not too sure how often the personal property would be used. It might be, but I also see a problem in regard to, I don't know who it is that's going to go out and kick the tires on the automobile. I guess it's going to be me to find out, you know, whether it's a good car and we'll run it around the block and that sort of thing.
You have to look in your blue book.
Yeah. Do I look under the buyer's or the seller's price? I also think that the clerks are going to have some problems with the storage of this stuff.
The clerks can do anything. We found that out over an election.
Can you give you the title, Judge?
Yeah. And they'll go apply for a new title and say they lost the old one. But I do think that. But if you're gonna have these provisions for the deposit of things, I think there ought to be a procedure set out so that it's uniform throughout the state in the way that you do this kind of thing. I would speak on the forfeiture and apprehension provisions. This section apparently contemplates a judgment against the sureties, if applicable, for the total amount of the security amount. My experience would indicate that such judgments in the event the 10% only is deposited would very, very seldom be collected. We're just going to have a whole bunch of uncollectible judgments kicking around. They're the same kind of judgments that we have now for costs and disbursements in criminal cases when we used to allow costs and disbursements. Nobody ever collected them or tried to collect them unless a guy happened to want to buy a piece of real property or sell a little real property. Why, they never were collected. I don't think anybody's going to collect them now. I'm a little concerned with the provisions if the defendant doesn't comply with the conditions of the release agreement. You'll enter an order declaring the security to be forfeited. Then you send the notice to be given forthwith by personal service by mail or such as other means as are reasonably calculated to bring to the attention of the defendant. If I knew any means that were reasonably calculated to bring anything to the attention of the defendant, I'd have the police run out and arrest him, bring him back. So I don't know exactly what these are. I think if you're going to have that, I think that you're going to have something which says that notice shall be given to the defendant and their sureties by registered or certified mail at an address which is to be furnished to the court at the time the release agreement is signed, and this will be sufficient for all purposes under the statute. I think you're going to have something like that.
And the attorney of record?
I wouldn't serve the attorney of record. Attorneys of record of absconding person's charged with crime's got enough problems without this.
Well, don't you think so, Madam Chairman?
Senator Cook.
Let's say that we go back to your illustration of somehow or another the defendant gives real property which he owns. Wouldn't it be reasonable that a judgment might be taken somehow or another? Or are you saying you don't need a separate judgment? Would the surety agreement be sufficient to be levied against that property?
Oh, I think when you get into this, Senator Cook, I think if you can figure out a mechanism by which you get this real property somewhere within the jurisdiction of the court by some procedure. And I didn't mean to overlook this quitclaim deed proposition, Senator, that you brought up. Maybe it would be a deed to the state of Oregon or to the county with the defeasance clause that says if he fulfills all the obligations, you have to deed it back. But once you get it within the jurisdiction of the court, I'm not too concerned about that. See, my problem is trying to get it in there first by some means. And you know the problems you get with bona fide purchasers and all this sort of stuff.
So what you're saying is that you should forget about the judgment after he's skipped, except as it relates to property that might be, that he would have given as security in the first instance.
Either the 10% or the surety. I think it, you know, I only point up that I think that this judgment is not very collective against the guy that's given. I do have some problems with that service, on how you're going to get service on the guy, and I think that it ought to be by some other method, by last known address. Then here's a problem that really concerns me. It says if he doesn't appear and surrender to the court having jurisdiction within 30 days from the date of the forfeiture, or within such period satisfy the court that appearance and surrender by the accused is impossible and without his fault, then you enter these judgments, which is fine. This impossible and without his fault is a real tough one. And you have to do all this within 30 days. The guy skips bail and he is in Seattle, Washington. And he says, I'm in jail and I can't come down, but it's a bum beef and it's not my fault.
You mean that he skipped?
No, he hasn't really skipped. He just went up to Seattle to go to the football game and identified his mother-in-law. She threw him in jail. And he's charged with aggravated assault and everything else that your mother-in-law can think of. And he says, well, that's all a bum beef, and I'm innocent.
Yeah, but if you would find that your hearing within 30 days, that appearance is not impossible because he's going to get out after he serves a 60-day sentence up there, I don't see why it makes it so difficult.
No, the situation is he has never been tried. And he says, my appearance is impossible because I'm in jail and can't make bail. But it's not my fault, because these are bum beefs, and I'll get acquitted of this.
Well, then he will appear.
No, he can't, because he's in jail in Seattle.
Well, the court would give a reasonable extension for him to appear.
I would if the statute told me to.
You construe this statute as not giving you that flexibility?
Yes, because it says within 30 days or within 30 days. See, it says 30 days twice. Within 30 days from the date, within such period. It says it twice. There's the same problem that the military operates. A guy goes home on leave, and he gets thrown in jail, and he says, it's not my fault. I'm really not AWOL. Well, if he's convicted of the offense, he really is AWOL, and if he's acquitted of the offense, he isn't guilty of AWOL, and they wipe it off. I also think that there's a real, and here's another thing. If it's impossible to appear in the Oregon court for the hearing, has he been given due process on the thing? I don't know.
How would you solve it? What language would you use?
I would follow what Senator Burns has indicated you could construe it, maybe. And have something in there if he doesn't appear and surrender within 30 days or within such period satisfy the court as possible. And have some language in there or within such other period as the court may deem in its discretion, which is necessary for him to present his defense to the charges. Something like that to get away from this 30 days. I think the 30-day base ought to be there, but I think you ought to have some flexibility in there. Also under this thing, it doesn't appear to give give the defendant a chance to come in and indicate that he didn't, that he did in fact comply with the conditions of the release agreement. In other words, there's no place for him to contest that. He's got to come in and surrender himself and this type of thing. One thing that really, really deeply concerns me is it appears that after judgment and execution, there's no provision whatsoever for remitting any part of the forfeiture to the defendant or to his surety. And that after these events occur, there would be no incentive on the part of anyone involved to locate the accused and return him to court. For example, I post $5,000 worth of sureties, 30 days are gone. You've taken my $5,000 and you sold whatever I deposited with you, and I've got no incentive to go get the guy, bring him back, because I'm not going to get anything back. Under the present law, the way it operates, at any time before judgment in an action on the undertaking, the bail may apply for remittance of the forfeiture, and the court for good cause may remit the forfeiture or any part thereof. For example, under the present system, there's $2,000 bail, and the bail pays the $2,000 into court. They try and find the fella. They find him. He's in Sacramento. The bail bondsman either goes down and picks him up himself. Let's say the bail bondsman goes down, picks him up himself, returns him to court. There he is. He's in jail. Or he applies for a remission of his forfeiture or part of it. The court has the authority to remit this. Maybe it takes the sheriff to go down and get him, costs the sheriff $500. Maybe you'd remit $1,500 of the forfeiture. At the present time, there exists a strong financial incentive for the bail to ascertain the whereabouts and secure the appearance of the defendant before the court. My experience is that the bail are apparently the ones most interested in doing this. Law enforcement, and it's in cases where law enforcement either haven't been able to find the defendant or have been unwilling to expend the effort to do so. Except in very, very major cases, law enforcement officers, in my experience, spend very little time trying to find bail jumpers once they brought them in and got them the first time and gone to. They don't spend that much time attempting to get the bail jumpers. But under the present setup, outside of, I suppose, sheer vindictiveness, there wouldn't be any incentive for anyone to bring the defendant back and have him there available trial, because it wouldn't do you any good to bring him back.
Are you talking about the proposed or the present law?
The proposed law. See, once the judgment is entered and you've got all his ATT, there's no provision at all that he can get it back. Even if he brings me in and says, here he is, take him. And all you can do for the guy is say, thanks a lot.
Well, Madam Chairman, I want to understand the judge completely. When you say there's no incentive to bring him back, but he's committed a crime, huh? And he hasn't been prosecuted.
He's committed two crimes.
Right. He's jumped bail pending the trial. And are you saying that your experience shows that there isn't a sufficient incentive to bring him back to stand trial for the crime that he committed in and of itself?
No. I'm saying that under the proposed system, there's no incentive for the bail who has lost $5,000 to attempt to locate him and bring him back. There's plenty of incentive for law enforcement to go get him and bring him back. But there's no incentive for the bail to attempt to locate him and get him back within the jurisdiction, because there's no provision for any
remission.
For any remission.
Well,
did I make myself clear on the difference?
Yes. But the obligation was still attached to the elected officials that have the responsibility for apprehending and prosecuting him.
Yeah. as I indicated, my experience is that we don't find many people who are simply, they've jumped bail. My experience is that unless they are arrested for another crime or they get picked up for a bad defective taillight and they run them through a records check, we don't get many of them that have jumped bail back unless the bail has gone out. And
well, you get a federal warrant for interstate flight, and my experience has been that the FBI is pretty good on apprehending those people.
Well, my experience has only been that apparently the great majority of them that I see that jump bail, either the prosecuting attorney hasn't gone to the, as I say, in real serious cases, I'm sure they go to the Federal Bureau, but in my experience, they haven't done it, and particularly in the misdemeanor cases. I don't even think, maybe you can get one, but I'm not too sure that you can get one.
Can't extradite on a misdemeanor.
Yeah. But on the other hand, you see, the bail can bring him back on a misdemeanor.
Well, generally, the forfeiture of bail on a misdemeanor, though, is insignificant.
Yeah. But on the other hand, still, if the guy can get him back and get part of his money back, I assume that he'd rather do that. As I say, I think this system has some excellent things that I certainly hope are going to be adopted. And most of my comments are direct things that I think will have some practical difficulties in regard to this. Another thing which I think probably should be taken into consideration is the fact that if persons are willing to wait in jail and they've been rested up, a large more proportion of them would be ROR than are being ROR.
What's ROR?
Released on your own recognizance. But they won't spend that much time. They want to be released right now. They don't want to wait till they appear before the court. You can talk all you want to about, hey, wait till Monday, and the judge will probably let you out, and they say, no way, let's go. And for that reason, I think you would have some difficulty with taking security and releases and this type of thing, like at 2 o'clock in the morning and this sort of thing.
You wouldn't in Lane County or Monroe County?
Well, not if you set up this release officer. If he'd be the same guy that's authorized to accept the surety to do all this.
I would in
Monroe
County.
And for that reason, if you eliminated the bail system as you have now, these guys would still be sitting there waiting for some guy to check over their used Volkswagen to see if it, you know, met the deal.
Senator Cook.
Is there a way to meet the problem of the middle of the night arrest?
Well, there's part of it is, if it's set up right, part of it is the release authorization, whatever he's called.
The release assistance officer.
The release assistance officer is part of it. Because I think he could screen X number of these through there, you see, and ROR them and send them to appear on Monday morning. But he's going to get some of them, and he's going to set bail on them. And if this is the only system that you've got in regard to it, is this system, you're going to have a lot of more people spending a lot more time in jail than you are right now.
You think that with this law, prevent the folks from getting cash back?
No.
Done.
No. No, it would not prevent the posting of a cash bail.
Why would they have more people in jail?
Well, I suppose it could work out that people would have a lot of cash laying around.
It wouldn't allow a surety
bail? No, it wouldn't allow a surety bail. It'd have to be cash, personal property. Yeah, if somebody's got, you know, like $2,000 laying around the house, right?
But it wouldn't allow a surety bail like we as presently allow.
No, would not allow a surety bail as we presently allow. So, as I say, there's going to be a lot of people laying around in jails for longer times, I think, under this system than there were under the system that we use now for the guy that wants to get out of jail.
There's really no reason why you couldn't continue the cash, security cash, bail bonds, along with the changes that are being done in security.
Well, yeah, except you can't repeal all the statutes on bail and do it. Yeah, no reason why the thing couldn't, why you couldn't double channel. And these are the ones that, the ones that want to get out in a hurry.
Further questions of Judge Allen?
I have two questions.
General Hoyt.
In the first place, wouldn't the release assistance officer probably be on duty 24 hours a day and be able to use the criteria of the judge and allow this person to go and join the cognizance?
Yes, I would hope in places like Multnomah County and Lane County, but I would hope, Senator Hoyt, that this guy would be a 24-hour-a-day fella.
Right.
And those he ROR'd, great.
So they would be, in that case, there wouldn't be any more in jail than are now over the weekend.
Don't know.
Well, I mean, wouldn't that answer your question that you raised a minute ago?
No.
About waiting till Monday morning?
Yeah. The only thing that I would say about this is I think that the release man would be probably not as liberal as the judge would be on these releases. I think he'd be inclined to be a little more conservative than the judge would be.
Other thing, Chairman, that really spooks me is I know the federal court is this 10% thing, but it seems to me like bail is pretty low anyhow, and using 10%, a guy could almost take it out of his pocket unless it was something pretty serious.
Well, and I suppose that's what they want done, is for the guy to be able to take it out of his pocket. I think one thing that you're liable to see, all I got to say is if you really mean it, say it, and that the commission intends that the security amount consider reasonable, the commission discourages the concept of establishing a security amount 10 times the amount the magistrate deems necessary. The concept of setting the security amount 10 times higher would be counter to the intent and spirit of this article. I think you're going to see in certain situations where a judge or whoever it is has got burned about 4 times real bad on this security deposit. About the time he gets burnt real bad, about 3 or 4 times, you're going to see instead of the $3,000 and the $5,000 bail, you're going to see the $30,000 and the $50,000 bail. And I think it's going to be more perhaps prevalent in the misdemeanor courts. Or, for example, a guy on drunken driving, he throws in $20 in the hat, Senator, and says, goodbye, Lucy. And the judge is going to say, well, if that's what's going to happen to my $20, I'm going to set the bail at $2,000. And he can deposit the $200.
Well, Madam Chairman.
Senator Keith Burns.
They've set forth from taking consideration over here, the ties to community and so forth, haven't they? So why would the judge do that if he have a transit coming through town in the car and got hit for drunken driving? Imagine they might want to do that, but they certainly wouldn't do it for a person living in the community.
Don't think so. What I'm saying is that it's the guy that's been burnt real bad about 3 times, where he's guessed wrong by using the release criteria. That's the guy that's going to do it. He's been burnt real bad by using the release criteria through no fault at all. You know, the guy fits right into the pattern, but he just doesn't show up for trial. I've taken too much time.
Let me ask you just one more question.
Senator Cook.
While you're here, I have a special interest in Section 247, which is the one that gives to the judge the
discretion to not allow bail after conviction and pending appeal. What's been your experience in Lane County, which is the only place you said you've ever had experience with this thing?
I have never seen it, Senator. I have never seen it, and I don't believe it's possible now under the present statute in misdemeanor cases.
How about in felony cases? What have the judges in Lane County been doing, or elsewhere, as far as you know, in felony cases, other than those that, where the court already had the authority to refuse bail?
I think that it's a matter of discretion for the individual judge, and I think that it has been used as the occasion demands. I'm sure that I've done it a couple of times.
You refused bail?
Yeah, refused bail on appeal. Denied bail on appeal. And I think all the rest of the judges have probably one or more if they've been convicted.
But what was your motivation in these cases, and what difference in effect did you see, if any, between what probably would have happened in the past where you did allow bail?
Well, on occasion, I thought in my own mind that this was a fellow that I thought was too dangerous to be out here. Others, it appeared to me like it was an entirely frivolous type of appeal. There was no justification for the appeal whatsoever. Statute says it's discretionary, and you exercise your discretion. That's the word of the religion.
Now, prior to the 2 years ago, what was your experience with the jumping of bail by those who had their bail extended after conviction but before the fruition of their appeal?
I had a couple that they had to look for.
Simon?
Yeah, they found one. I don't know whether they've ever found the other one.
Judge Allen, are your suggestions in writing, are those your suggestions?
Principally the basic suggestions.
Could we have them?
I think it's the same one that I...
The same one you may have seen.
Yeah, it's the same, basically the same one that I forwarded to you in regard to...
Fine. Thank you very much. Mr. Richard Mann, are you from Medford? The Portland people, getting...
I'm living in Portland. Mm-hmm. My permanent home is in Medford.
Well, I'm trying... I have several Portland people, and it's very late. We're going to have a further hearing. Anyone who has come from a long distance and... in this term is meaning further than Portland. Is there anyone here who would...
I can come back, sorry. Right.
Is there anyone from... Yes, sir, where are you from?
I'm from here.
Well, aren't you up here rather regularly?
This is the second time in the last time.
Oh, is it? All right, then come in.
My name is Rick Barron. I'm an assistant DA from Coos County, and I believe that I'm representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association on this. I have submitted to the committee a list of proposed changes, so I will be very brief. I might first start out by saying that the District Attorneys Association does not oppose, and we do agree with the favor and presumption of the release on his own recognizance. The thing that we feel that should be in the bill that is not is that there is no place that provides that we have a right to appear and be heard in relation to recognizance release or bail release. The present statutes give us that right. Since at the time of arrest and from there on, criminal justice, as all proceedings are adversary. And we should have a right to appear and at least be able to give reasons why a person should not be able to be released on his own recognizance or as to what bail should be set.
Where would you see that you would appear before this release the assistant to officer?
Even there, yes. If he's on 24 hours a day, I don't see why a district attorney cannot be called at night. They say, we have John Doe. He wants to be released on his own recognizance. Do you have any information as to why he should not be released? The judge in this does not even have to hear the district attorney if he doesn't want to. If it comes up in hearing, the district attorney not only does not have a right to appear, but and in my proposal, I merely say he should have a right to appear and be heard in relation thereto. The judge would not even have to hear a district attorney if they didn't want to. I'm not saying they wouldn't hear a district attorney.
Senator Keithburn.
Ordinarily, the time you're talking about the release officer, the defendant wouldn't have an attorney at that stage, would he?
No, he would not, but the release assistance officer would be taking down, would be asking him all the questions and would be relying on his word as to everything that he states.
That wouldn't be much of an adversary proceeding, though, if you appeared and his attorney didn't.
Well, we would be able to, at that time, it would even be less of an adversary proceeding if the release assistance officer merely took down everything that the defendant said and at that time said, well, I believe everything you say and released him. You're relying on the defendant who is being picked up and possibly a defendant who's wanted in another jurisdiction to say, yes, I have ties in the community. No, I don't have any prior arrest. No, I'm not running. This, I think, is completely unfair. The state should have a right to say, we have a warrant on this man. He's wanted in another jurisdiction. It gives us no right to appear. And in fact, the right can be refused. As I see this, the judge could say, I don't want to hear you. The statute doesn't give you a right, and we don't have to. The other thing, I'm not here on behalf of the bail bondsman. I'm sure they have enough people here. I would point out that in Section 244, the study shows that 10% of the people that are bailed under the present law run, and that this is in the commentary, under relation to existing law, and 10% run under the proposed system. I would only point out that at the present time, we have a way to get a judgment against somebody who's going to pay. Under the proposed system, our only judgment is going to be against the defendant, and it would seem to me that a defendant who would want to run is going to be judgment. He would have no way to collect any money. Specifically on the conditional release, one point, I would think that instead of having three separate types of releases, recog, conditional, and security, you would only have two, recog and security, and conditions could be applied on both. I don't see, if a person cannot be recogged, I don't see where a conditional release is any more effective. But a judge should have the right, I feel, to put conditions on both bail and recog. There should only be two types of releases. In relation to what Judge Allen said about the supervisor in Section 248 saying at the last minute that the defendant's not here and I didn't tell you, the proposal that the amendment that I would submit would add one line. It would say a supervisor of a defendant on conditional release who knowingly aids the defendant in the breach of his release or who knowingly fails to report a defendant's breach is punishable as contempt. I think that somebody should, the supervisor should have an affirmative duty, as Judge Allen says, to tell the court that the man has run. And in relation to 248, it says punishable by contempt. This is merely wording that sounds as if the judge would merely say, I find great contempt for you. It should say punishable as contempt, I feel. 242, these would be the last things I'll point out. 242 and 244 and Section 237 seem to be in some conflict. Subsection 5 of 237 points out release agreement means the defendant signed something and if applicable post security. 244 also talks about signing a release agreement and posting security, but 242 in sub 1, the last three lines, it says that he shall sign a release agreement or deposit security. It seems to imply that you do one or the other, and the other section seemed to say that you should do both. I think that anybody that posts security should also sign a release agreement, and this should be made in all cases, and 242 should be made to comply.
comply with the rest of them. The rest of the changes, I think, that the DA's Association would like the committee to look at are suggested in the proposal that I submitted. I submitted two copies to the committee.
Fine. Mr. DeWinter, are you able to advise us when we can continue this hearing on Section 8?
Madam Chairman, we could continue the hearing in the next subsequent work session. And I could
it isn't plausible to do it on Wednesday.
See what we have to on Wednesday, we have scheduled hearings on Article 9. We could have carry over these hearings from that time also.
I think we'll probably have quite a few people. When else could we have it?
Well, we could move it down to February 26th, which is the work meeting scheduled for Parts 3 and 4, and that would then put our work meeting on again until all of the hearings have been completed.
Is there any article that's a short article that we could work it in? Or you think the 26th is the best?
Of the 26th, or we could, we're scheduled to hear Articles 7 and 10 on February 19th, which would be next Monday. We could hear Article 8 at that time.
Well, I think maybe we better put it on the 26th. As for your original suggestion. So this hearing will be continued on the 26th on Article 8, and I apologize to you Portland people for having come so far, and I realize a number of you are bail bondsmen, and we haven't heard from any of you, and we certainly do want to hear from you. And this has been a peculiar day in the Senate where we've been extremely busy, but we certainly would give you adequate time. Yes, sir.
I'm going to interrupt. Federal Judge James Burns asked me to read his views. I have already submitted my own views on just a type statement. I have a very short statement from Federal Judge Burns, and if I could just read this, it's only take 30 seconds to read it.
If you would,
I will not be coming back.
Yes, right.
May I do that now?
Please do.
My name is Jerome Labar. I'm an attorney from Portland, a former deputy district attorney in Multnomah County. Statement I wish to read from my views, as stated in my type statement, represent my own views. I also support the bill on behalf of the ACLU. Federal Judge James M. Burns asked me to read the statement dated February 12, 1973. This is to authorize Mr. Labar to state to the committee my views as to Article 8. I endorse it heartily. These are my views as a citizen and a former state circuit judge, particularly chief criminal judge from Multnomah County, January to April 1972. Article 8 would do away largely with the present evils of the system. These are my views formed and held before I ever went on the federal bench. Signed, James M. Burns.
Would you read that with us, please?
Yes.
Thank you very much. The hearing will be continued on 26th. The meeting is adjourned.